from one of you asking about perception, perception problems on the homework set, and I realized that, first of all, it's not easy to do over email, but secondly, probably more of you would be interested in thinking about it a little bit. So I took a picture of the problem so we could talk about it, and you can see how well that worked out. Let me see if this helps. Okay, so it's problem 1171 or 1071, I forget what. Anyway, so here's the problem. Sort of fuzzy and dark, but a boy rolls a tire along a straight level street. The tire has, you know, a mass, a moment of inertia. The boy pushes the tire forward away from him at a certain speed and sees the tire lean. Okay, so you are looking at this picture from the perspective of the boy. And how will the resultant torque affect the subsequent motion of the tire, etc. So it does have a quantitative piece, but what I wanted to do is at least make sure we're all on the same page in terms of what physically is happening. Right, so you are the boy. The tire is rolling away from you. What direction is omega? That's almost the other way. Right, okay. So this piece is moving away from you. This, in the rolling, this piece sort of comes toward you. So it's rolling like that, okay? Put your fingers along that. Omega is that way, okay? What direction is the angular momentum? The same way, okay? What direction is the torque? It's a little hard to see anything on this drawing. So, here's a schematic of what's going on. So, where does the torque come from? It comes from the fact that you have a force on this thing that acts through a line that doesn't pass through the axis of rotation, if you think about it that way. When I'm talking about the axis of rotation now, I'm really talking about the axis of this body rotating like that. Because if you don't worry about the thing spinning, if I take this body and I lean it and I let it go, it just falls right over. Right? So that is the axis of rotation down here. And that's the torque. That's the unbalanced force that basically causes the torque about this axis. Torque is defined as R cross F. In this case, the F is mg. This is R times mg times the sine of the angle between them, if you want to think about it that way. There are two ways to look at this. One is, really, the formal definition is R runs from the axis of rotation to the point of application of the force, which is like this. So if I take this vector and I put it down so they're tail to tail, I do my right-hand rule. I put my fingers along R, curl it into mg in the plane that contains the two along the angle that's the smallest between the two, and my thumb is into the board. Okay? Or mentally, you can sort of just project out the perpendicular piece, which when you calculate the torque is actually the relevant piece, which is just going to be this line, because this thing acts like this. So it is this line that's perpendicular to that line of action that turns out to be the actual magnitude of R that you're using in your calculation. The direction really hasn't changed, but if you think about it this way, then mentally you might more or less take your fingers and put it along that relevant R, curl it into F, and you have a torque into the board. You okay with that? If it's spinning and it has an angular momentum, then we know this equation is true. It's a vector equation, so the change in the angular momentum has to be change with respect to time, is in the same direction as the torque, which may seem sort of strange. If it is not spinning, the wheel just plops over. But if it is spinning, it has an angular momentum. And what this tells you is that the torque is into the board, which means the angular vector, angular momentum vector, has to change, but it's not changing in magnitude, at least not very fast. So it has to change its direction, and its direction will change in such a way, it's as if you're adding a little vector to it, and that vector you add to it is into the board. So the angular momentum vector, if this is my finger, okay, it's going to rotate like that. When it does that, the whole wheel rotates to the right for you. Okay? If you think this is really weird stuff, good. It is. Okay? So, every time I look at it, I go, this is just almost too weird to be reality. Okay? So in this case, the mathematics is really telling you what happens. Okay, and your intuition is easily misled. But this is very important. So you're riding a bicycle, what do? You want to turn this way, you lean this way. Why? It gives you a nice torque and rotates your tire. Okay, the other way. So. But it's also true that because of angular momentum conservation, this system is much more stable the faster it's spinning. So when you're going fast, you feel very stable on a bicycle, right? Try doing it without hands when you're going really slow, and it's very hard. But it's a lot easier if you're going very fast. If you screw up, it's a lot worse, but okay. Any questions? Okay. So it is very strange. I find that these problems are very hard to think about sometimes depending on the visualize, sometimes depending on the direction of this L. If it's this way, I seem to have an easier time visualizing it than when it's that way relative to the problem. And so you have to play with this a little bit. So you might imagine looking at this problem and imagine it rolling, leaning the other way, and see if you can get it turning to the left in your mind. Okay, so the next thing we covered, we've been talking about static equilibrium. And basically, there what we have is a system, and we want to find the condition where that system is in static equilibrium. And static equilibrium means that it's not going anywhere. And if it's not going anywhere, then it means that the net sum of the forces vectorially on the object has to be zero. And the net sum of the torques has to be zero. And that would be torques about any axis. Because what you're saying is it's not rotating, and you're not even... That's a general statement, so any axis you choose. So sometimes you'll find that it's easier to visualize for some axes than others. So we did a bunch of problems on that, and of course I'll assign you a bunch, so I want you to get good at it. I find mentally these generally are easy, especially after you've been bloodied back with sessions. There are some subtleties. You have to think your way through very carefully what forces are in the problem, and sometimes that force may not be so obvious. So we did a problem where we had a sign hanging on a rod that was pinned to the wall. And there's a force of the pin on the rod. And it's very easy to just say that normal force is perpendicular to the wall or straight up. But in fact, it's at some weird angle. And the only way to really infer that is to look at the other forces in the problem and realize if it wasn't at an angle, you'd clearly have unbalanced forces and the thing wouldn't be in static equilibrium. And you can do that without solving or anything. You have to look at the forces. So set your free body diagrams up and your problem, set all the forces up very carefully. If you jump into rushing through the calculation without all the right forces, it doesn't matter what you calculate. You won't be right because you're leaving an important piece out. So just be careful with that. it is a very important thing, of course, if you're an engineer. I mean, one of the things is really, thank goodness they learned how to do static programs, because building construction has a lot to do with that. But I think in biomechanics, it is also very important. So for many of you, you may find it fairly interesting. But, I mentioned this last time, but let's look at slightly more quantitative detail. I mean, if you're just doing weightlifting, simple curl, okay, and you just ask, all I want to do is hold the weight like this. I mean, physically, what's going on, if you're in static equilibrium, you have a force up here and a force down here, and you do have a force that your bones hold. So translationally, there's some big force here that's holding everything up. That's true. Okay, and if you were worried about the stress on your shoulder, you might worry about that. But in this case, I want to only worry about the rotational aspect of it. And what we have is the muscle right here that inserts into the bone. And we can say that there's an insertion distance, some distance away from the axis of rotation. And I'm approximating this, right? I'm saying that insertion distance is a point over here on the bone, and that this axis is like a little metal pin, which of course it isn't quite. So it's, if you were going to do real biomechanics, you'd have to worry about this approximation. But the essence of it will remain true. So you have this big mass over here, and it has a much larger lever on it. So I just wanted to point out, for a given force in this muscle, so if you have, some people are really strong, some people less so, if you can exert a certain force with this muscle, you can imagine that, I mean, if you look at the static, that's one of the torques is zero, which means this distance times that force, that torque acts to rotate this thing counterclockwise. This force has a torque that rotates you clockwise, but if you're holding it, you're in static equilibrium. So you know that some of the torques is zero, which means this torque and that torque are equal in magnitude. So imagine having two different people that can exert the same force here, F. The amount of mass they can support is going to scale directly with the distance here, with that insertion. So for the same muscle strength, and it's a linear scaling, if you have this insertion point 50% further out, you're going to be able to hold 50% more mass for that same muscle force. Right? So I was joking in class last time, but I think it's actually probably true. If you look at the highest levels of athletics, the odds are, if we dissected those people, we would find that they have things like insertion points that are a little further out than your average person, right? They are sort of mutants. That's quite a that's part of why this is great. I'm sure, hard work and lots of other things go into it. I'm not trying to minimize it. But, there is such a thing as a natural athlete at some level, and we can boil it down sometimes to ask things like this. Lung capacity, this, et cetera. It ain't always fair. Any thoughts? Yes?
So when you say this comes to zero, it's because you do the right hand rule, little df, you get it going out on the page.
Yeah, if I do the right hand rule here, r would be a vector from here to there. And so I put my fingers along that, curl in f, it'd be out. And for the big one, here's r, f, it'd be in. So they're in opposite directions. That's important in some types of problems, which we've sort of been doing, especially with precession. For this type of problem, actually, I don't even bother thinking about it that way. I just think that this force causes me to rotate that way. This force causes me to rotate that way, and I just make sure they come in with opposite signs in the torque zone. So for this kind of problem, I never do a cross problem. I just picture that rotation. But if you always do cross products, that's fine if that's the way it works for you. Any questions? Okay. So, I have to pick and choose some of the topics that we do in this class. And if you were to look at syllabi for different professors, you'll find they're a bit different. I make a particular choice in this class that I don't generally regret. Most of you have chemistry and stuff. So I sort of take thermodynamics and push it to the end, and usually it falls off the end and we don't end up doing it. So you get some of that in chemistry, and if you're taking one of your professional exams or whatever that requires that, just understand that they may very well require it, and they might think of you having had that in class. One of the things that I typically put in that some professors don't, but I think is on various tests, but I also find just a lot more fun and useful for this class, is fluids. Just the study of fluids. So I think most people find it one of the fun topics for this class. So that's where we're going to head next. So we call it fluid mechanics, and as we've sort of seen in the past, when we have things in a static state, it usually sort of has one name. So rotational kinematics are sort of a stable rotating system, and the rotational dynamics are when we have to throw in the vectors and we have things sort of changing more. So we have the same thing in fluids. We have fluids which we call statics, or sometimes you might see it under the word hydrostatics, where hydro means water, and of course water is the most obvious fluid that you would think of. So if your job was to design water flow in a town or something, then you know, you would be thinking of hydrodynamics or hydrostatics or whatever. We are not going to be confined to just water, although it was probably the most common fluid we'll talk about. What we will say, though, is that the fluids that we deal with, so it could be air, it could be honey, it could be water, it could be oil, or whatever, for us, we'll say that they are incompressible. And water, to a very large extent, practically is. Air, as you well know, is quite compressible. If I take air and I put it in a container, I can really compress it. There's no question that that's a very compressible. But if we talk about air flow, say around an airfoil for an airplane, or an airplane wing or something, it's not really compressible. It just flows across. So it flows across baseball and footballs and stuff. So it just acts as an incompressible fluid there. So we'll be studying it in that limit for the most part. So I have to define a few things for us to be able to talk about fluids. One, I just want to remind you that we have a symbol rho that we use for the volume density of things. So this is the mass per unit volume, and in MKS it's kilograms per meter cubed. And we define something called the specific gravity, which you may have run across in chemistry, which is defined as rho of some material over rho of H2O at 4 degrees centigrade. Now, if I had never heard it before, this would seem pretty damn arbitrary to me. But why in the world would you ever define something in such a silly way? Density changes in temperature. So why not define it as absolute zero. So I hope you've picked up in chemistry before now. Right, water is at its densest at 4 degrees. You might ask yourself, why does water float? Well, because it's actually denser when it's a little bit warmer and it's not ice. When it's a little bit cooler, it's actually slightly less dense. So the reason that you define this particular quantity is because, practically speaking, in principle, you can go and you can get water and you can measure, you can change its temperature. So in the lab, in principle, you can actually go and make measurements. I mean, this is a very relevant real-world sort of definition. And it becomes very relevant when we consider what it means for something to be able to float in water. So it turns out that if an object has a specific gravity that is greater than 1, that is, its density is greater than that of water at its most dense, then it's going to sink. And if it's less than 1, then it will float. And it's really that simple. And right as you, when you get around to where you have a density that's roughly the same as how the density of water changes between, say, 4 degrees and 50 degrees, then you may have to look at the relative change. So that would be the only place where this might be a little strange. But since you've defined this where water is at its most dense, these definitions basically work. Okay, so that's one way to think about it. And we will mostly be using water. All right, so now I want you to use your imagination. I want you to imagine that you go to the swimming pool. All right, so we're all in the swimming pool. And you have a piece of paper, more like a piece of plastic wrap, like the thin stuff you wrap in. And you take that plastic wrap, and we're in water, right? You take it and you put it under water, and have it like this, and I let it go. What happens to the plastic wrap in the water? Can you imagine what may have happened? I mean, you say, well, the same thing happens to it as happened to the paper. And that's sort of true. But not really right away. When I pull my hands away, it really just sort of sits there. Very slowly settles down. Right, there's a lot of, I guess, friction or viscosity, if you want, in terms of it flowing through the water. That's not exactly the direction it likes to flow. But it really just sits there. Or another way to think about it is if you take your hand and you put it down deep in the water, you don't really feel a force pushing you up or a force pushing you down on your hand if you have it out like this, right? You sort of feel sort of stable there. Okay? So let's think about what that means physically. So let's suppose we have a big vat of water. Within this water, we consider something like this piece of plastic. So that represents an area, if you want to think about it that way. And what I'd like to do is consider the forces on this piece of plastic. Well, let's not worry about anything transversely. That just complicates the world and I think is irrelevant for this. We know that there is the force of the air up above the water that pushes down the water. We know that there is a force of the water up above the plastic pushing down on it. Or if you want to think about it, we have the force of the air pushing down on the water, which then is conveyed as a piece of this force. So if we look at the force on the plastic, we have this F down, which is really the essential piece. And then we will have some sort of, you know, normal force of the water up on the plastic, because if we didn't, it would go crashing to the floor, which it's not doing. It's more or less a air. So because it stays there, let's think for a moment about what this F down has to be. So we have this area, and we can imagine projecting sort of a squared pipe-like region straight up. So if you think about it, this piece of plastic is supporting the weight of everything that is above it in the column. Some of which is water and some of which is air. Okay. So the force down is equal to the force due to the air on the top plus rho of water, which is the density of water, times the volume, and this would be our volume, where I'm defining the volume for the water to be just this region, times G. So we have some force of air on the top of this column, and then we have the weight of the water. And I'm sort of neglecting the weight of the air per se, although I guess that's tied up in the force that the air pushes down the top. So the part of the problem with thinking about it this way is the total force you have really depends on how big an area you've got there. But clearly, if I have sides here which are very big, then this V becomes very big. If I have, so I'd like to scale that out. So one way to do that is to just divide these things by the area, where the area would be the cross-sectional area here at the bottom, for example. Okay, so if we do that, what we have is a sort of a quantity, I guess, we haven't seen before. And this is a force per unit area, which is what we know as what we've defined as a pressure. And in MKS, that would be newtons per meter squared, which is a quantity that we call a pascal. But we'll run into some other forms of that unit. So if we rewrite this equation in terms of the area, in terms of the pressures, then we have the pressure at the top of the paper is equal to the pressure at the top of the water plus rho times g times the height of the water. This is the volume of the water, okay? And we divide out the area. The volume is equal to this area times its height. So if we just look at the height of this column of water, V over that area is just equal to the height. An equation that you'll end up using quite a bit in hydrostatics. In terms of pressures, we talked about pascals. Other things you'll see are atmospheres. And in terms of pascals, that's 1.013 times 10 to the fifth pascals. It is particularly useful in atmosphere because it's basically a measure of pressure that's relevant for everyday life. So on an average day, at average temperature, etc., you would have a pressure that's about 1 atmosphere. Okay, so that's sort of where it comes from. So in terms of atmospheres, things tend to be nice whole numbers. You clearly, that's not true for pascals. There's another unit called millibars, and we'll see more about what that is in a minute. In an English system, 1 atmosphere is equal to 14.7 pounds per inch squared. Okay, so, yes?
I have a question. Can you pull up a little bit?
Yeah, I'm basically saying that if I consider the force down on this area, it's going to be equal to the force exerted by this bunch of water plus the force exerted by whatever the air is doing on top of that column of water.
So did you say it's not...
You should all take your sandwiches to the pool. I'm sure that they'll love that in the gym. Take the saran wrap, they'll really love that too. But basically, if you do what I said, if you do this and you let it go, do it in the tub tonight. Your roomies will think you're pretty weird, they'll notice, so you need to sneak it in. Because if you do this, it will largely just sort of sit there. It will eventually settle to the bottom, but it's a pretty slow deal. Yeah.
Would you actually consider the force of gravity on the actual
paper that's around? Okay, so this is a great question. Do we consider the force of gravity on the saran wrap itself? And the answer is, in the real world, yes. I'm ignoring it here, which is why I chose saran wrap instead of... I mean, if I chose... You know, a piece of slate, you know, I mean, it's massive, then it would just fall. But if you choose something where that's negligible, it's kind of hard to just sit there, which is sort of what I'm trying to say. Okay. So we're going to come back to this. let's say it's not really super tight, right? If it's super tight, you squeeze it, what happens with this bus, right? But if it's not super tight, and you squeeze the water balloon, what happens? It just expands out here, right? Because the water itself is basically incompressible. So if I compress it this way, it's got that volume has to go somewhere else. Okay? And you know, the water balloon bursts when the plastic gets stretched to the point that it can't expand anymore. So there's a law which we're gonna use, which is called Pascal's law. And I'm not big on writing laws, but this one is pretty useful, so. But I can't spell. It says that the pressure applied to an enclosed fluid is transmitted undiminished to every point in the fluid and the container walls. I squeeze on this thing, and it transmits the pressure out, 4 times area, stretches the balloon elsewhere, right? No grain. So what I'd like to do is to take this simple idea and pursue it for a moment. Let's suppose that I have a steel pipe, and this steel pipe has a very particular shape. I'm going to make it look something like this. Draw that so well. This needs to be straight down. And now, on the two ends of this pipe, I'm going to put basically a plug that can slide. So, like a valve sort of thing. So I'm going to put a disc right here. And we're going to say that that disc has a radius of 5 centimeters. And then on, over here, I'm going to put a disc. And this will be a bit ridiculous, but we're going to say that this disc has a radius of 2 meters. So it's a big pipe. Okay? And now I'm going to take a rod that goes up from this disc like so. It's a sturdy rod, and on this I now place a chair, and on that chair we're going to plop a baby. And because we are fabulous parents, we're going to strap that baby in. Okay, it ain't going nowhere. Okay? And we're going to say this baby has a mass of, God, I don't know, 25 kilograms. And on this other side, I'm going to put a rod. And on this rod will be a platform. And on this platform, I will have some mass. And what I would like to know is, how much mass can I place here and have this system in equilibrium? This disc is free to move. This disc is free to move. And I fill the pipe with an incompressible fluid. You might imagine that the total mass over here and the total mass over here have to be equal. If I basically had some sort of a device, like the inverse of a string, some sort of a metallic thing that was flexible that wasn't compressible, then, and I made it a mechanical problem, then the mass down here and the force of the mass here and the force of the mass there would have to be equal for this not to be going anywhere. Right? Now in this case, I have a fluid. And here's where the magic of Pascal's law will become apparent. Pascal seems so obvious and so simple. The pressure applied to an enclosed fluid is transmitted undiminished to every point of fluid and the container wall. Let us look at the implications of that. So that means that if I exert a pressure here, that pressure is transmitted everywhere. Okay? If I exert a pressure here, it's transmitted everywhere. So that basically means that, except for this slight difference in height, the pressure is the same both places. So let us consider the pressure here. I know if the kid is in equilibrium that the total force up has to be the same as the force of gravity down on the kid plus the support structure there, which is 25 kilograms times g. Alright, I'm going to have to go back and forth. So if we consider the kid here, we know that the force of gravity and the force of the water have to equal out. The pressure on the kid is equal to the force per unit area, which is equal to the force we know has to be mg, so it's 25 kilograms times g, 9.8, divided by the area, and in this case what I have is the area is that of a circle with radius of 0.05 meters. So the area of a circle goes as pi r squared, so this is pi times 0.05 squared. And this would be in pascals, m. That pressure That's the pressure here, the force per unit area, then that also has to be the pressure up here because of Pascal's law. So that means that that pressure is equal, and this is by Pascal, to the amount of mass I have on the other side times 9.8 divided by pi times the radius on the other side, which is 2 squared. And now if you calculate the mass, what you find is that the mass is equal to 40,000 kilograms, which is about 80,000 pounds. It's a hell of a baby. So, yeah, the baby could, this could be like a pretty good sized truck. It's pretty weird. You ever heard of hydraulics? Have you ever looked at a backhoe? You know these things outside construction places that have the big claws and doing this and pulling up big rocks and stuff? Have you ever noticed what they have for their muscles and tendons? You notice there's these big silvery pipes. Have you ever wondered what's on the other end of that pipe that can take it and do this and pick up a huge rock like that? That pipe is a cylinder that's going in and out of tubes of water or oil or something like that. And you're using hydraulics. You can quite literally use this kind of game to put a small force here and exert a huge force over here. Right, because the pressure has to be the same. Right? So it's a way of gaining huge mechanical advantage. Now you might think that, wait a minute, this is not to violate conservationist something. If I push down here, an inch, how much work do I do? I have the force that this kid is supported by times that one inch or whatever. So it's not a huge amount of work if you stop and think about it. And you think, well, it's got to be a huge amount of work to take this car and pull and push it up an inch. It doesn't go up an inch, right? Because you have volume continuity, volume conservation. If this goes down an inch, I have only a small volume of water that I'm pushing out of here, which means that volume of water goes into here, which means this goes up only a tiny little ways because its area is so much bigger. So the height change isn't so much. So the net work I do is the same. So energy is conserved. So that basically means I can push down here and push up this truck, but in a sense, I have to push down on this side a long ways to get the truck to go up very much. So usually it's set up with some sort of weird system. If you've ever played with a hydraulic jack, what you find is you've got this big column on one side, and you use this to lift the car. Okay? On the other side, you've got a little tube to another side, which has a little handle and a tiny little tube thing here. And you just do this, and you do this, and you do this, and you do this, and slowly the car arrives. So you are quite able to lift the car, but you have to do the right amount of work. So you're not breaking conservation energy. Cool stuff. So you can tell Grandma about this over Thanksgiving as you're driving through construction zones.
You got solar thing. Look.
It's cool. I think hydraulics are sort of neat. You guys okay with this? Yes.
How about you didn't have the fish?
I've ignored air pressure here completely. So you could imagine this is a vacuum. Might not make the kid very happy. That's not that I've ignored. And even if we took it into account, we would have an air pressure here and an air pressure here. That pressure would be the same on each. And that would also be unequal. And in fact, it would be much larger over here. But I'm ignoring that. We have here a polished piece of glass and a piece of glass that can fit along the bottom. What I'm going to do is to hold that glass so that it's up at the bottom here, okay? And then I'm going to put this whole device down into this vat of water, beaker of water. And then I'm going to let the stream go. And what do you think is going to happen? Because I basically am sealing the bottom more or less, that will have no fluid except what sort of leaks in that cup. But what do you think will happen when I let go of the string and I am not physically holding this thing to the bottom? Down at this point, which is basically for the rho GH, the height of the water here, pushing up at the bottom, but I have no water on top except what may be leaking in. Okay with that? And so that's why this thing now stays. It doesn't fall. So now I'm going to take water with the dye in there so you can see it, and I'm going to pour it into this cavity. This thing is supporting with some weight on top, but still not enough to balance it out. When the height of the fluid reaches the height of this water, if I go any higher, there's going to be equal force and the thing's going to fall. But up until then, if I'm going to blow it here, it should just stay where it is. Imagine we have a configuration. I don't know what it'll be for you guys. But I remember both in high school and an analytical lab in chemistry class, totally taking mercury and pouring it out on the table and doing this for them. What would happen if you had that? Did they even let you near the mercury? I don't know. Yeah, so I haven't died yet from that, but it is really outrageous, some of the things that you had no idea how dangerous they were. You know, later on you find they're really outrageous. So mercury is really fun to play with, so I can't recommend that you do it, but it is really cool. So I'm sort of sorry for you that you can't. It's really cool. But the reason that I'm talking about mercury is that it's a really neat neat fluid. And it has been used for years for measuring pressures. And you don't have to use mercury, so probably you have different fluids in your labs these days because we've gotten rid of most things that have mercury in them for labs. But in the old days, we would have a glass tube like so, and you would literally fill it with mercury. And you take it, and it's open up at the top, and you literally plop it down into another tub of mercury. So that you would have the opening at the bottom. The tube would go up like so. And you would have the opening goes below the mercury height in the van, in the tub. And you would actually end up with an evacuated area up at the top, which would have only sort of the vapor pressure of mercury up above it. And so if we look at what happens right at the bottom of this column, we know that the pressure at the bottom of the column is equal to the pressure coming down from whatever is up above the mercury plus rho gh, where rho is the density of the mercury. And G is, you know what it is. And you have this height of water. You basically have, I mean, if you're doing a really precision measurement, you have to put in a P0 here, which is the vapor pressure of the mercury in the vacuum, but at that temperature. But you can assume that's basically zero. So this P, the pressure here at the bottom, is equal to rho GH. If we consider really this right at the liquid interface, I guess, then we have the air pressure pushing down, and the pressure pushing up has to be equal to the pressure, air pressure, because the heights now are equal. And what we have is this rho gh, where h is the distance from this point up to the top of the mercury column. So the pressure you have here is the air pressure. And the pressure on the other side of the equation is given by this. The density of mercury times G times the height. And so this is a device that you can use to measure, it's a barometer. You can use it to measure measure air pressure. If I have a higher air pressure here, literally this pressure pushing down is greater, that pushes up, and this mercury will rise in the column. If I have a low pressure front coming through, I have less pressure here, this weight doesn't change, which means basically this mercury now will push out, and you'll have a lower amount of mercury that you can support. Okay. And since this is the way that you used to do this in the lab, we used to say that a pressure of 1 torr is equal to 1 millimeter of mercury. So remember, I didn't say anything about torr, did I? 1 atmosphere is equal to 760 torr, or 760 millimeters of mercury. So I don't know if you've ran across this in your books or whatever, but you'll find pressure measurements in terms of millimeters of mercury. And if you've ever seen seen one of these things, you may wonder, why? Okay, that's why. You could use a different fluid if you want. Mercury is really great because it basically doesn't evaporate. I mean, if you use water, you have to have this open to air and it will evaporate. You have to correct for that. Also, the vapor pressure of water in this region is higher, and you have to adjust for that. You have to adjust for temperature. So mercury is nice in that it's much less sensitive to those kinds of things. So I don't know, you tell me, do you have these devices in mercury in the lab these days or something else? Do you know what you need? You know what fluid is? Yeah. Okay, and so ethanol or something. It's the same issue with thermometers, right? I mean, there you're just using the expansion of the thing to the temperature. But okay, so that's a barometer. Okay, I want to give you one other thing. I should have gone ahead and copied this, sorry. There's another fluid principle that we're going to have to use. And it's called Archimedes' principle. And this is the thing that you want to come back to whenever you see a problem that has anything to do with buoyancy. Floating in water, ice floating in water, hot air balloons rising, anything like that. Whenever you see such a problem, I want you always to go back and start repeating Archimedes' principle in your head. It says, when a body is completely or partially submerged, the fluid exerts an upward force on the body equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. As you know, the boat goes down into the water some. The boat will go down into the water until it has literally pushed out enough water, has displaced enough water, that that amount of water is equal in weight to the weight of the boat. Okay? I'm going to do... We'll do a few problems with this. And this seems really straightforward, but what I'm going to warn you about is that the problems are really deceptive or counterintuitive sometimes. Always, 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 always come back and repeat this to yourself and start from this for any problem. If you don't really come back and think about what this means in the context of what you're looking at, you're going to be hosed. Okay? So, and let's do a little bit so you can see what I mean. It's very straightforward once you realize you always have to come back to this, but you do always want to come back to this. But let me prove it to you first. Let's see what I've got time for. Okay, so... First, I'm going to prove it to you, then we'll do a clicker problem so you can sort of understand some of the subtleties. We have what's known as a scale balance. If I pull harder down, you see you get a measure of it. So, literally, it is exerting a force that is equal to the force of which gravity is pulling down on this stuff, most of which is dominated by this mass. Okay? So that is at about 5.4 or something, which is supporting the weight of the snap. Now, what I have is a cup here that basically has the internal volume that is the same as this mass. It fits very snugly in here. And when I push it to the bottom, you can see it's pretty snug. So this represents, the inside of this represents the volume of this. Okay? Now, I'm going to put water in a container here. And it's got a hole at the top so that I sort of have a measure of the level of the water. So I'm going to let the water drain out so that the level is appropriate. And I'm going to pour this water back in here. Now what's going to happen is I'm going to lift this whole thing up so that this mass becomes immersed in the water. As the mass is immersed in the water, it will displace some of the water. As it displaces water, that water will come out into here. Okay? And I'm going to lift it up until the level of the water is right at the top of this mass. So what we'll have is an amount of water in this beaker that is equal in volume to the amount of water displaced by this mass. What's going to happen here as the water comes up? What do you think? It's not going in yet. I'm just shaking the thing. So we're going to hold the water. Right now, I'm beginning to get the water to touch the bottom of the mass. What's happening to the spring scale? Why is it decreasing? As the mass displaces the water, the fluid exerts an upward force on the mass equal to the weight of the displaced water, which reduces the necessary force with which the spring has to pull up to support the mass, but there's this other force. So the spring senses this to weigh less. I mean, you feel like you weigh less when you're in the water, right? It's the same thing. And if you were standing on a scale, you would weigh less. All right, so we're almost there. And now the water pipe is right at the top edge of the mass. Why does it not read zero? The density is very different. The force with which the water is pushing up on this mass is not equal to the mass of the mass. It's equal to the weight of the displaced water. Since the aluminum is much, much denser than the water, that is not the same as the force of gravity down that mass, right? It's much less. All right. I now have the displaced water that's not being supported by the spring. I'm now going to take that displaced water and I'm going to put it in this cup. And let's see what happens to the mass, to the measure of the mass. And it came back pretty much to where it was. So, what does that show you? I added an additional weight that was equivalent to the weight of the water displaced, and it brought the scale back to where it was, which basically is saying that the fluid here was pushing up with that much force, equivalent to the weight of that water. Okay? So Archimedes knew what he was talking about. Alright. So now, let's not bother with the clicker because we don't have a lot of time. But let's look at this problem. We live near the Erie Canal. So suppose you go down to one of the canal lots and you see a boat coming in that has a huge chunk of iron on it, right? And so the boat comes into the lock. The lock is a sealed pool of water. And you make a mark right here, which represents the level of the water in the lock. Okay? And then, the people on the boat, nothing else changes, but the people on the boat take this pile of iron and they dump it over the side into the lock, into the pool. And what I would like to know is what happens, how does the level of the water in this new situation compare to the level of the water here? Does that level go up relative to this? Is it unchanged or does it go down? If you think it's unchanged, then it's here. If you think it rises, that is, this goes up, you want to choose B. And if you think the water level then drops, you choose C. So just think about that one for a moment. How many of you think the water level is unchanged? How many of you think the water level will rise? A handful. How many of you think the water level will drop? So if I had to guess, it looks like the number said A and C is about the same. Or so B. So I find if I give this on a test, actually most people buy it on B. Okay? But let's think about what actually happens. In this case, the amount of the displaced water is equivalent to the weight of this boat plus the weight of the iron. Alright, that's how you have equilibrium. In this case, the weight of the displaced water is equal to the weight of the boat and the volume of the iron. The weight of water that would be equivalent to just the volume of the iron. Right? In this case, there is a buoyant force on the iron, but it's only equal to the weight of the water that's equal to the volume of the iron. So the iron weighs a little bit less in the pool than it would otherwise. But when the iron is up here on the boat, the amount of the displaced water has to and you have to displace enough water that the weight is equivalent to that iron, which is a lot more water than is the amount of water which is equal to the volume of the iron, because iron is much denser than water. Okay? So in this case, you displace a whole lot more water than you do here, which means, as strange as it may seem, you take this and you throw it overboard, and the water level drops in the water. Okay? So that's a little bit subtle, And I do guarantee you that if I gave it on an exam, lots and lots of people would say B and A. Okay? And the only way to think your way through it is to really go back to Archimedes. And what does Archimedes really say? Right? And the weight of the displaced fluid. And so go back to that with all those problems. So, okay. Have a great weekend.